This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. America's LGBTQ plus community says it's living in a state of emergency. Much of their concern is about their access to health care. In this excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, Dr. Marwan Hadid and Dr. Carl Streed join host Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner to discuss related issues.
Let's start with Dr. Streed. You're on the faculty at Boston University's Chobanian and Avedisian School of Medicine. In November, you'll become the president of the U.S. Professional Association for Transgender Health. The Human Rights Campaign says 35% of transgender youth live in states that have passed bans on gender-affirming care. What harm do you think this will cause if the bans are fully implemented?
Thanks for that question. I feel like it's important to recognize that while the bans themselves are egregious, they're not evidence-based, they're going to cause direct harm, I think it's important to recognize that the conversations even around these bans are really harming people even across different state borders. It's causing significant degrees of distress, anxiety, concerns around depression, and lots of questions around access even in neighboring states, because a lot of folks are still having to travel to different clinics very far away because so few folks are actually able to provide gender-affirming care for youth and adolescents, and honestly, even adults. Myself, as a primary care doctor who provides gender-affirming care for adults, I have patients who are traveling hundreds of miles to access care because there aren't enough of us who are able to do that. I think one thing also to really point out around these bans is they're hyper-focused around access to medications and surgery when gender-affirming care is really much more than either of those. And the care needed for youth is often more focused around educating the family, making sure the youth is supported, that they have a safe environment and that their community is safe for them. Medications and surgery, if indicated, are only part of that conversation. They are not the only part of the conversation.
Well, Dr. Streed, as you know, a lot of conversation going on in the country, and supporters of these bills say that they're really just protecting children who are too young to understand the health impacts of such care. I wonder what you say in response to this issue, particularly of the age of children, and what does it mean to be too young?
Oh, I feel like this is such a loaded kind of question because we allow folks to make decisions at a variety of life-changing decisions at different ages. But again, the focus is really trying to make sure that the youth are supported in whatever decision they make that makes sense for them. And that this is not just somebody's made a decision all of a sudden and that the doctor is going to prescribe or going to do surgery immediately. This is always something that's been in conversation with a multidisciplinary team for a very long time, honestly, for many folks. This is not a decision that's made lightly for anyone. And this is a decision often made in conjunction with a multidisciplinary team and always with the support of family, essentially.
If I can just ask you to clarify, and we do hear this a lot about young, are there age or is there evidence for certain ages at which it's appropriate to begin having the conversation, or is it whenever the child and family are ready to have the conversation?
I think it's more about when the child and the family are ready to have the conversation. They're the ones who should be really, like the child, the youth, the adolescent are the ones who really should be dictating their care. That's how we need to be doing it in general. We should be listening to the patient in front of us. That being said, of course, we have very clear guidelines about when we may consider medical or surgical interventions. And those are the guidelines we should be following from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, of which USPATH is part of. So it's, again, one of those things where this is not uncharted territory, really. This is really something that has clear guidance, has expert input, has more and more evidence supporting the provision of this care. It's more a situation that I often see where politicians are making policies without evidence and are not seeking the input of the people affected and not seeking the input of experts who are providing that care.
Well, Dr. Hadid, we, of course, know you very well. In the spirit of transparency, you're the director for the Center of Key Populations at the Community Health Center, and the health center is part of the Moses Weitzman Health System. And I'm wondering, what do health systems mean when they say they offer gender-affirming care and hormone therapy, and what does that involve?
Thanks for that question. I think it's very important to really sort of define what that is, because a lot of times I think people just focus and hone in on exactly what Dr. Streed was saying. It's about medications, and it is a lot more than that, right? So for me, it means that that these health systems provide a welcoming, safe, respectful environment for the LGBT and transgender and gender diverse communities, and that all the staff is well-versed, well-trained, and culturally humble, right, when it comes to interacting with individuals in the LGBT community. It means, for instance, things like being able to accommodate and appropriately use people's names and pronouns. It means that we have expertise in providing quality care in issues and conditions that affect the LGB and transgender populations, including medications like hormone therapy. But as a note, there's much more to delivering comprehensive patient-centered care, which is the bread and butter of primary care health centers like ours, much more than just hormones. And health systems, I think, need to understand and provide this holistic care. And lastly, I think, and ideally, they also have a resource and referral network that also provides safe and respectful care for the patients.
Well, maybe for both of you, are we losing this battle in terms of definition where everything is viewed only in one context? And what can we do to better educate people across the board about the more comprehensive view of the work that's going on here?
I mean, I feel like it always comes down to actually knowing who's affected and really sharing narratives, really sharing the stories of who's having trouble accessing care and highlighting the harms that are happening from this legislation that's already been passed in too many states, but also highlighting the positive benefits, the joy that we see from youth and adolescents mm-hmm. and adults who are able to access gender-affirming care. I mean, honestly, for me as a clinician, there isn't a week that goes by where a patient isn't just happy, joyful, or will honestly say, like, you saved my life by providing very broadly gender-affirming care. So we have to share that information. We have to share those stories. And then also we have to really lean into not backing down from any one of these battles. It's essentially, I kind of describe it as somebody is essentially setting fire in different homes. And we have to go to each one of them and put out each one of them with the same dedication we would for any others. It is an ongoing fight to make sure that people know who's benefiting and who's being harmed by these egregious policies.
Well, that goes to the recent study that found that transgender children are 3 times, I think, as likely as the general population to have anxiety and depression, neurodevelopmental disorders. Mm-hmm. And we note that the U.S. Justice Department has said, and I'm quoting here, no person should be denied access to necessary medical care just because of their transgender status, including transgender children. There's so many questions about this out there. And Dr. Haddad, what about the argument that the medications used for gender dysphoria lack the FDA's approval for this use? Where does that fit in?
There are a lot of things, as we sort of say, that we don't have FDA approvals for that we use in medicine across the board, not just in transgender health. And so I think first, we need to acknowledge wholeheartedly that we do need more research in gender-affirming care, and we need more funding for research, right? We need more active recruitment and inclusion of transgender and gender-diverse individuals in all research across the board. But that doesn't mean that we don't know how to care for transgender and gender diverse individuals. As Dr. Street said, in the US, we've got experts in many fields of medicine and prominent medical organizations that support the gender affirming care and that we have these guidance and guidelines. And just because we do not have all the research done doesn't mean you ban gender affirming care legislatively across the board and increase further barriers for kids and adolescents in particular, but also adults in seeking the care they need and deserve. So gender affirming care truly, as I think Dr. Street was alluding to, means in many ways supporting the social transition. What do we mean by that? That means allowing kids to wear the clothes they want, cutting their hair like they want, playing with the toys that they want, providing that sort of safe support for families and for the patients to say that, yes, it is okay for you to sort of feel this way. And means providing the counseling. And at some point through all the shared decision-making, right, with providers, patients, with families, medications may be prescribed around the time when puberty, you know, before puberty is going to hit. So puberty blockers do delay onset of puberty. And so you can start those until such a decision is made, shared, right? When they want to go through puberty and which puberty they want to go through based on their gender identity. We hear from our patients all the time that if a trans kid is about to go through the puberty of the gender that you do not identify with, that is a very serious and critical time and a dangerous time for them. And so I think a lot of these decisions are made together with the families, with the providers. What has to happen, though, is that we cannot have that interference and being dictated by legislation. These are decisions that are made in the context of the provider-patient relationship, and they need to remain there. As we sort of said, the harm in withholding this care to the transgender community is really detrimental and can be fatal.
You know, Dr. Street, let me just pull the thread on Dr. Haddad's statement about more research needing to be done. Critics say instead of offering puberty blockers, clinicians should understand children could just be going through a phase and that watchful waiting and talk therapy should be used for gender dysphoria. I'm wondering if that's an area of research, and also, what's your reaction when you hear comments like that?
My general reaction is I'm getting tired of us having to try and chase the moving finish line, as it were, in terms of, oh, this is the evidence that we need, or like, this is the research question that people should be focusing on. We should be focusing less on whether gender affirming care actually is good or bad, and focus more on how can we do it better, and how can we make sure that we reduce any potential risk from any intervention, just like we do for any medical or surgical intervention. We have to really understand and characterize it. Right now, we're fighting the battle of like, is it good or not? And honestly, anybody who's actually providing gender affirming care can see it firsthand within their own patient population. Any researcher who does this seriously can also see at a population level that there is significant benefit from the provision of gender affirming care, including medicine, surgery, as well as broader additional services. So my general response is exasperation when people are asking for more research to prove that it is beneficial or not. There's so much within medical and surgical care that, yes, we need more research. We always need more research to better characterize the care we're providing. Just because we need more research, that does not mean we stop providing the care. Honestly, just because we have issues with regards to potential adverse outcomes, that does not mean we stop providing the care, because we then find ways to actually reduce the adverse outcomes. We then find ways to make sure who's going to benefit the most from the interventions, and so on and so forth. Too much do people focus on very small numbers of adverse outcomes for only apparently gender affirming care, rather than looking at adverse outcomes for anything else. Again, this just for me highlights the ideological and political motivations around these bans, rather than the actual evidence or care about youth and children or the constituents of these elected officials.
Well, I know that both of you are probably equally expert at the one-on-one relationship with the patient and the exam room and the family, but also in the national circles where the policies are being made and dialogue is happening. The American Medical Association and the Academy of Pediatrics both support gender-affirming care. The Pediatrics Academy just authorized an expanded set of guidance based on the systematic review of the evidence. But we have this pushback. Florida says not enough scientific evidence to prove that treatments improve health. And the United Kingdom, I understand, is largely stopping the use of puberty blockers, citing this gap in evidence. That's a lot, I know, to unpack, but I'm curious if you're finding that the support from your professional associations is clear and strong enough that you feel you have that backing of the professional associations going forward, or any concerns in that area that there's going to be a push on professional associations to move in a different direction.
I'm personally grateful for our professional associations for actually, again, sticking to the evidence and not caving to any kind of pressure. As somebody who is actively involved in organized medicine through the American College of Physicians, Society for General Internal Medicine, the American Medical Association, these are all associations that have really focused on trying to make sure that we understand the evidence, that we acknowledge where there are gaps, and really try and push the science forward and make sure that clinical care is based on that.
Dr. Haddad, do you want to add anything to that? Or
I think our associations have really been great at sort of stepping forward and pushing back against these legislations, but I think we cannot let our guards down. And to this point, I think we were always going to get sort of pushback. From my position at the HIV-MA, I mean, we've been hearing about threats of pulling funding for pediatric residencies, right, who actually teach gender-affirming care. So all of a sudden, it's coming at all levels. And I think we need to constantly be very vigilant at the advocacy piece, at really, truly honing it back down to what it is that we really want to do, right? At the end of the day, we want to protect our children, our communities. And to do that, we truly need to engage all our communities in care. Right? And it's not by banning care. Right. In treatments. It's by investing in this care. It's investing in the research that we need to further the betterment of the care, investing in the holistic care, improving the access and decreasing barriers to care, and building on what we know from experts as well. Instead, like what we said, what we're seeing is almost the complete opposite of what's happening. We need to continue to push back. You mentioned at the top of this over 520 anti-LGBT bills in state legislatures this year alone. There are 22 states that have banned the medical and surgical care for trans youth, with 5 states making it a felony crime, right, to provide this medical care to youth. So you can imagine the impact not only on the patients, the communities, on the medical sort of teams, on the recruitment of, you know, we talk about the workforce and the lack of the workforce. It's affecting recruiting good physicians and clinicians to these states to be able to provide this good care to patients. And we just need to continue to really focus on the advocacy and the voices and really push back. And so far, I feel that our associations have really been doing that.
And Dr. Street, you were talking a little earlier about gender at birth, and you've written the following: as clinicians, we strive to be accurate. The evidence shows that using male and female as the only options in birth certificates is not consistent with scientific reality. Wondering you can explain why you think the medical profession needs to do a better job of understanding and accepting this issue. And is it only in the medical arena, but also in the public health departments and others who are probably in control of what gets put in a birth certificate?
Absolutely. I mean, you're bringing up this notion of how we are trying to provide population statistics on who are we trying to take care of, essentially. But the notion of binary sex is something that has been only really recent in medical history in terms of from the late 1800s onwards. And it is not an accurate representation of all of the ways in which people, in which bodies are actually created, as it were. There are people with differences in sex development or intersex characteristics that do not fit neatly into our notions of a binary sex categorization. And oftentimes there's a lot of harm in trying to push people into those boxes. So there's been a significant movement to try and understand ways to update our medical training, update our public health, essentially statistics and data structures, to try and avoid these potential harms, both intentional and unintentional. So there's been a lot of efforts to remove, for example, as you've alluded to, the sex designation on the public portion of the birth certificate, because birth certificates are something that we carry with us for a number of issues. Even though it makes no sense that I have to show my birth certificate for employment, it's there. And for trans individuals or people born with differences in sex development, that can be a very harrowing experience. It can be an experience where they are effectively outed and could be discriminated against based on that that information. So we're trying to find ways of reducing unintentional harm from essentially government use of information around people's bodies, as it were. There's much more we could talk about this. I do think this is a little, it's related to what we're talking about, but it's also a much bigger can of worms, as it were, because I'm talking about trying to break down binary categories, and the medical profession is so focused on binaries, and we are really trying to update that.
We may have to come back and revisit the issue in another conversation, because it was certainly a fascinating one that I know I did not have on my radar. So I appreciate your comment there.
That was Dr. Marwan Hadid and Dr. Carl Street with host Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner in an excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast. The podcast is produced by Community Health Center, Inc., Connecticut's largest provider of medical, dental, and behavioral health to the underserved. Coming up, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra opens its 2023 concert season, Catch the Spirit, with the concert entitled Resistance, on September 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Bellmehus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. Experience the power of Beethoven's music, including Eroica Symphony and Egmont Overture. This performance will stir your soul and emotions. More concert information and ticket availability can be found online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Tom Ezern brings us a Plainsfolk essay, this one titled Quite a Historical Character.
Brief press reports went out from Mandan in February 1890 recounting an act of violence, saying, a Negro barber named Julius Wales stabbed another Negro barber named Henry Wagner in 15 places with a jackknife. Wagner is in a precarious condition. Oddly, that is the extent of reports. We read nothing as to the recovery of Mr. Wagner, nor as to the legal fate of Mr. Wales. Evidently, the matter was just left to rest. Not that surprising, as the violence was black on black. And in some respects, the report was typical of the treatment of African Americans in the news of the day, with its intimation of passionate violence. 15 wounds, after all. I am struck, however, by one detail, that the wounds were inflicted not with a razor, the tool of the barber's profession, but with a jackknife, like any man might carry. It seems important that the stabbing not reflect on the profession. The historian Douglas Bristol, Jr., published in 2004 a scholarly article on black barbers through the 19th century and early years of the 20th. Which situates them as businessmen in white society. He says they were the most successful African-American businessmen in the 19th century, who practiced their arts with wit, savoir-faire, and tenacity. To accomplish this, Bristol says, the black barbers had to do two things. First, create and operate respectable, even luxurious establishments in which white patrons felt comfortable and pampered. Second, establish a persona, a mask of unthreatening geniality. Because shaving, he says, rather than haircutting, was the mainstay of 19th century barbers. Theirs was, literally, the story of the black man's razor at the white man's throat. Which brings us back to Mr. Wales and his jackknife, not his razor. It is impossible to find out much more about this African-American businessman. He was a married man, having wed a woman named Caney Mulker in Burleigh County in 1882, and I know that before 1904, he relocated to the little town of Grand Harbor in Ramsey County, where the Devil's Lake Interocean published a brief sketch of him. It reads, Julius Wales, the Grand Harbor barber, is quite a historical character. He is 65 years old, was a slave before the war, and, running away, joined the Union Army. When Julius Morgan, the rebel guerrilla, made a raid in Ohio, Julius, that's Wales, was instrumental in his capture. Wales and Morgan had played together as boys, and when Morgan, dressed in farmer's clothes, was driving past some Union soldiers who were searching for him, Wales recognized his old playmate, who was identified by a scar on his head. Morgan was sent to prison in Ohio, but escaped, went south, raised another army of guerrillas, and continued his operations against the Union forces. Now, although Mr. Wales, the barber, told census enumerators in 1890 he was a veteran of the 41st Ohio Infantry, I rather doubt that. I suspect that as an escaped slave, he went to work as some sort of laborer for the regiment. But that's not my point. My point is the richness of his story, which, no doubt, he told to customers in his chair, many of whom likely were Civil War veterans themselves. The old soldiers would have been entertained by the narrative, and they would have settled in comfortably for a shave or haircut. Just how comfortable, though, were black barbers like Wales in Dakota? The evidence is thin, but there are more stories.
That was Tom Easern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming up, a preview of Knotstock, Minot State's signature arts event. But first, this news.
Good afternoon. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Just in time for the weekend, an upper atmosphere low pressure system is about to bring some much needed moisture to North Dakota.
So today won't be a total washout, but especially as we get towards tomorrow evening and through Saturday, I'm really expecting widespread showers, maybe a few thunderstorms in there. But unfortunately, Saturday especially is looking like a washout for most of the state.
Megan Jones is meteorologist with the Bismarck National Weather Service. She says while the system will bring much-needed moisture to parts of North Dakota, the areas in most need will likely see the least amount of rainfall.
Divide to Rolette counties especially have the lowest chances of seeing any really substantial rain totals. Certainly could still have some showers and thunderstorms, but when we start looking at the highest likelihood of those really substantial rainfall totals, 1, 2, maybe even 3 inches through this period, the north is unfortunately looking the least likely to see that, which has also been the driest area of the state for a bit.
Jones says unless there's a shift in the pattern, south central and southeast North Dakota could see 2 to 3 inches of rain today through Sunday. And it's been an exciting start to the 2023 school year for the campuses of the North Dakota State College of Science. Officials say after several years of slumping enrollment numbers, things are looking up.
Well, it's our highest since 2013, so a decade ago, and at 3,140 students this fall.
Lisa Karsh is an executive vice president at SCS. At their lowest, the Wahpeton and Fargo campuses had an enrollment of 2,800. Karsh says most of the school's programs held steady or posted slight gains in enrollments this fall. But she says the school's dual credit program has been the silver lining to this year's numbers.
and dual credit is we're offering college level classes in the high schools. We have high school students coming here to our Wahpeton campus and also to our Fargo location, like taking welding for college credit.
And Carr says one unusual development to the fall enrollment is the fact some traditional technical studies programs are still lagging behind.
Those were programs that were bursting at the seams. And now we're trying to figure out different strategies and how to tell other students about what this career looks like.
Carr says officials are looking at ways to help promote and build awareness around those programs. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Knotstock is Minot State's signature arts event held every year since 2007. It gets underway today and runs through Saturday. From a recent episode of The Great American Folk Show, here's host Tom Brousseau with a preview.
Knotstock is an annual event that takes place in Minot on the campus of Minot State University, now in its 16th year. It's a weekend festival that celebrates arts and education, poetry, pottery, music, and at the heart of it all is screen printing. This year's Knotstock features Polish-born and trained multimedia artist Piotr Szachalski, who draws upon propaganda aesthetics in his work. He created some 225 posters, one a day during the first 8 months of the pandemic, called Labor Camp. It's at the epicenter of this year's Knotstock. Here to talk more about it is the directors of Knotstock, Lori Geller and Bill Harbert, and also Greg Vettel will join us, the director of the Northwest Arts Center at Minot State University.
Actually, what prompted this was I was taking a class on the history of rock and pop music and had to do a project, which then I did my project on gig poster art. And so that started a conversation with my colleague, Bill Harbert. And from there, just spawned an idea that took off, I guess, and is still going. So.
And that's kind of the nature of Knotstock, is printmaking, poster making. What is it about that particular slice of the arts?
It's a souvenir. It's attached to some memory, some event. But then it became about even more than that. It also became about a particular artist sometimes that I was interested in and started to then appreciate their artwork. You know, so starting with a particular band, then to an artist, and then sometimes it's about technique or something that I might appreciate. So whether it's letterpress or screen printing. And so it's kind of changed over time, and I think the internet has had an effect on all of that too, because when you could only get these at shows initially, about the mid-90s, all of that changed and you could get them online anywhere, and then you could follow a particular artist or a particular band.
So that was sort of the main focus of Knotstock originally, and that went on for many years. But now Knotstock has grown into these other areas. More arts are included. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We started with the gig posters, just coming, connecting the music and the image. And from there, that led to, well, we should include ceramics. So then we invited our ceramics faculty member in and set up pottery wheels outside or hand building or raku and did that. We also added theater and some improv so that we get students involved that way and people who are interested in that form of art. We've had film. We've had music, obviously. We've had spoken word poetry, more of traditional poetry or writing. And so it just continues to grow. If somebody's got an idea, we're open to that and being inclusive of other types of arts.
Bill Harbert is our next little guest here on today's Great American Folk Show. And we're talking about this year's Knotstock in its 16th year, which is really wonderful and quite an accomplishment. How many people are behind Knotstock?
There are, so many contributors. So many enthusiasts, so many fans, It's not uncommon to get an email in the middle of summer, when is Knott's Dock coming? Or on occasion, I'll see people in town in Minot here wearing a Knott's Dock t-shirt. But the support, the people that really carry the weight, are on this campus and sometimes even extend out into our community. It's pretty humbling at times to just look around at Knott's Dock and nearly have to pinch my thigh to hold back tears because I get those kind of moments of like, wow, this is all going down. It's an awesome experience.
Bill, what is your position out here at Minot State University, and how long have you been here?
Yep, I've been at Minot State University for 27 years, and I'm a professor in the art department, and I teach mostly design and graphic design. I teach some drawing and other kind of foundation courses.
Next is a little visit with Greg Vettel, and he is the Northwest Arts Center Director. Let's talk about this year's printmaker, who's going to be here. He's sort of the premier printmaker for this year's Knott's Dock. Can you talk about
him? Absolutely. So this year is a little bit of an interesting twist for us. The entire Knott's Dock is going to be outside or in the Art Center. Usually we make use of some other locations on campus. And when we were planning this year's Knott's Dock, we ended up maybe going a little bit outside that gig poster, you know, concert poster theme that we've had. And the artist for this year's Knott's Dock is Piotr Zahalski. And he's a Polish-born, Minneapolis-based, not just a printmaker, but a new media artist, audio. The exhibition is Prints from the Labor Camp. Labor Camp has been Piotr's kind of arts project since 1998, and he uses it to kind of reinforce the quiet dignity and the honor behind work and labor and common work. As an artist originally from Poland, I think he was deeply influenced by his own native country's history in terms of looking at democracy and government and that struggle. The exhibition itself centers around one of his main projects in recent years called the COVID-19 Labor Camp Reports. And those are a series of illustrated posters that Piotr completed in 2020. So he started when lockdown and when the pandemic started. And they are some incredible, poignant works responding to the pandemic, the common shared experience that we had.
You know what I want to do? I actually want to take the mics into the other room.
Yeah.
And perhaps we can walk around to the one that
comment
kind of speaks
on
out
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, comment on that one or a couple.
Would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we are in the Walter Peel Gallery. This is the famous Walter Peel Gallery.
Yeah, dedicated
and,
to Walter.
Set the scene here. Usually there's all sorts of art and exhibits that are happening, but now Knott's Dock is here, and this is devoted to
Piotr's work, so Prints from the Labor Camp. So depending on, you know, which door you take to enter the gallery, the first thing that becomes immediately apparent is just the gallery walls, which are 12 and a half feet tall. 10 of that feet is posters.
Let's go to the one that you want to talk about here.
There's one that kind of still sticks with me, and it's an illustration of your standard, like, iPhone brick, but duplicated three times vertically. And each image contains, in the top image, you have a person in an empty room, half in shadow. The middle phone is engulfed in flames coming out from the screen, and the last phone is a single solitary house. And the poster is captioned on the top and bottom, everything, all the time. And that one to me just spoke to, during the pandemic, and this would have been April 2020, there was all of this that was going on, and you could not stop it. You had to experience it, and it kept happening, and it was all-encompassing and overwhelming. And that's what that poster kind of communicated to me, and it was one of the things that resonated.
How do you think this this exhibit will be received?
I would hope that whoever views this exhibition will just take a look at kind of that shared history of what was happening, whether they agree with the message of an individual poster, because some are, you know, quite political in nature, as art often is. But even with those posters, I think that people can find some that resonate and have a quality that will respond to that person. And even just some of the imagery is quite beautiful, too.
Well, thank you, Greg Vettel, for being on the Great American Folk Show. And Bill Harbert, thank you, too. And Laurie Geller, thank you so much for being on the Great American Folk Show.
It's been a pleasure, Tom.
Thanks for being here, Tom.
American Folk Show airs Saturdays at 5 p.m. here on Prairie Public. Coming up, Sue Balcom.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Members of the Talking Heads sued one another and publicly criticized each other and now gather in the same room. The re-release of their film, Stop Making Sense, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Root Cellar Sue. Sue Balcom owns and operates the Root Cellars Farm outside of Mandan, and she joins us once a week to talk about food and gardening. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And a little bittersweet.
End
the
of
end
summer.
Of the growing season.
Yeah, it's the end of growing season. But if you're like me, well, you're probably not, and you have like an acre of garden, you're thinking to yourself,
no one's quite like you.
It can't freeze fast enough in September sometimes, and we're coming up on October, so the nights are cooler, the days are cooler, and I love cool days, and they're still. You know, it's kind of like there's a time at the end of the year that the leaves are turning and the wind isn't blowing so hard. And then one day, all of a sudden, the weather changes to winter and then it blows like crazy and there goes all the leaves. But I've had this urge to pull the plants out of my garden and get the weeds pulled and get them. I water the soil down really, really well in the fall. Like I'll just run water in it so that it has moisture over the winter when it freezes. Of course, in October, I have to plant my garlic. But if you're done with your garden, like if your leaves are brown and your vegetables are picked, then it's time to button up your garden. There's just a few things that I'd like to tell you to do that will make your spring a much happier time to plant. So,
okay. Get us started.
First of all, you've got to harvest those vegetables, you know, and you've been picking them as they mature. And we talked about what to do if your tomatoes don't turn ripe. But there are a few that you definitely, I leave my carrots, my cabbage, my pumpkins, and my potatoes and squash, winter squash, not zucchini and other summer squashes, in the garden till after. They can survive a frost or two. There's a difference, you know, between a frost and a freeze.
Sure.
A hard freeze is definitely going to kill everything down to the ground. Definitely let it freeze before you pull your plants out of your garden. They'll take up less room. Mm. It'll be easier to see if there's any fruit on there that you might want to separate out from, you know, your burn pile. You know, throw it in your compost bin as opposed to on your, if you can have a burn pile. One of the things I'm going to try this year in one of my tunnels is, and I've thought about this before, you know, over the winter, things will continue to decompose. And so I'm going to cut my cucumbers off right at the soil line, and I'm going to leave the roots in the ground, and I'm going to water, and then I'm going to cover that soil up with lots of grass clippings because we've had a really good year for haying out there next to our house. And so that will protect that soil from erosion. It will protect it from the sun. And all those little tiny roots that are down there under the soil line that are going to decompose, because cucumbers are a soft vegetable and they don't have like enormous roots, will be places for all those bacteria and worms and other kind of beneficial microbes in your soil to crawl around and make your soil more beautiful. And then in the spring, I'm hoping to just like part the way there and plant right into the soil without doing any hand digging. I don't ever really use a tiller in my garden. We harrow the big gardens up. Harrow has little fingers on it that stirs the soil, whereas tillers will compact the soil down about 6 or 7 or 8 inches when those tines hit, every time they hit down there. And then if you have carrots that don't grow straight into the ground, but they split off and grow 2 short roots, you know that you have a little bit of hard pan under your soil. You need to work that out. So harvest those vegetables. Wait for old man frost. Or is that a young man frost? It's old man frost, isn't it?
Yeah, I think
so. I can't remember
Jack
now.
Jack Frost is what I'm thinking
of.
Oh,
he must be young, Jack. Anyway, he'll kill those plants off.
Frost feels like a cranky old man.
He does. It does, definitely. Now, one of the things, like I talked about separating the, you know, if you have like rotten tomatoes or stuff like that, they'll end up on the ground anyway as you're pulling your plants out. If you have had disease, and I know from talking to other gardeners that we have had a lot of trouble with cucumbers and squash and those other plants in those families having, because it was so hot and humid, they have a lot of like powdery mildew issues and black spots on their leaves. I was really disappointed in my cucumbers this year, and my pumpkin foliage is not as thick and heavy as it normally is. And I do think it's because of the heavy, wet air and the intense heat that we had when they were growing up. So if they show signs of disease, you want to definitely burn those things to the ground, but do not put those in your compost because you might be actually spreading disease. There's also, if you've had any kind of, let's see, one of my, my sister-in-law said she had aphids on her peppers. I would definitely make sure to not compost anything that has potential insect eggs on it. So get that stuff out of your garden. It's good to keep your soil covered if you can possibly do that with lots of straw or hay, and then rake that off or dig it in the spring, because the soil doesn't like to be bare, and you know the winds blow around here. But once the snow falls, I guess we don't have to worry about the soil blowing anywhere. I guess we had so much snow on our garden, we weren't able to plant anything until way late in May, because we could not, we had to wait for that snow and that moisture. Our whole house was surrounded by about 8 feet of snow. And I heard from the almanac, I read in the almanac, we're supposed to have kind of a cold winter this year. So, you know, El Nino and La Nina, they switched. So, but I thought that was going to heat us up. Well, we'll wait and see. We'll talk about that in December, okay?
Okay.
So you want to maybe check your soil pH and maybe do a soil test this time of year, and then you can add some amendments to your soil this time of year. Now, what you want to do, especially if you're going to use any kind of compost, we always ask that you do that about 180 days before harvesting any vegetables. So the fall is really the time to put any rotted cow or horse or chicken manure. Well rotted is the key. If you get it from someone who knows about composting, it's been heated and turned enough so that the weed seeds are dead. We have introduced some awful weeds in our garden over the years because our compost was, or our manure, sheep manure, wasn't composted well enough, or it was composted and weeds grew over the top of it and dropped new seeds in there. So it's really good for that. Leaf mold, decomposed leaves add a lot of nutrients and structure to the soil, but you do not want to use cottonwood, you know. That North Dakota tree that everybody hates.
They're so beautiful.
I love cottonwoods. And you know what? When the leaves shake in the wind, it sounds like water. Did you ever notice that? It sounds like a river running by. We have a beautiful cottonwood in our yard, and I love it. But the leaves are waxy and big, and if you don't grind those up with your lawnmower, they will kill your soil because they won't allow any oxygen.
Oh, yikes.
And those anaerobic bugs, they need a little bit of oxygen to get going there.
Okay.
So,
okay.
You can add peat moss if you choose to, you know, my garden is too big to afford to dig peat moss in. So we rely mostly on the fact that we have river water that we use from a tiny little ravine that has lots of fish and foliage in it, and we figure that that's our secret. There's tons of nutrients in that water, and it's warm because it's in a small area. It heats up in the summer, and your roots love that. And we have sandy soil, so it doesn't, you know, if you've got gumbo soil, which you might have if you garden in the Red River Valley, you want to definitely dig some things in there that will, like sand, to improve your drainage in that kind of soil. And you can actually buy bags of topsoil if you have small garden beds that you want to. You know, it seems like in my small beds that they kind of lose soil over the years, you know, either from pulling the plants out and then dirt comes with them. And, you know, then you need to keep layering, layering composted materials, layering topsoil. Covering with leaves, not cottonwood, unless you grind them
unless
up.
You grind them up.
You can also buy cow manure in bags from Runnings and places like that. You can use ground up bark. I've never done that before because I can't imagine that it wouldn't have to be really ground up because it would take a long time to decompose,
you
think? But that supposedly improves your soil structure, which is kind of what you want to do. And you want to protect it from erosion in the wintertime. So, you know, those are just kind of a few things you want to do. Oh, wait, I forgot the most important part about this. You absolutely want to collect some seeds.
Oh, yeah.
You know, definitely, if you're out there, like right now I'm pulling Cosmo seeds and zinnia seeds, you know, once a plant starts seeding out, it will quit, you know, your flowers will quit blooming, your cucumbers will quit growing, things like that, because that plant's goal in life is to survive. And to survive, it needs seeds. So once you are done with your garden, allow some of those plants to actually get seed heads on them and then go out and collect them, share them with your neighbors. I got all kinds of people that want black hollyhock seeds. Dill seeds, we are always out of dill when there's cucumbers at the farmer's market. So we do succession plantings of dill. I got this from my friend Diane. She's like, every time you pull something up, you got an empty space there. You want to definitely sprinkle some dill seeds in there. And then, of course, if you don't want dill everywhere in your garden next year, be sure and pull those before they go to seed. But I collect a lot of dill weed. It's called dill weed for a reason. dill weed seeds, and then make sure they're thoroughly dry, absolutely thoroughly dry so they don't mold. And then we save our big cinnamon shakers and put them in there, and then you got a little thing where you can just shake your seeds out into the ground.
Smart.
Very handy. So
smart.
Get that stuff out of the garden. Get your garden ready for next year. I've got some weed pulling I still got to do, but I'm all about that when the weather's cool.
Yeah. We check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Ashley. It's my pleasure.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation. Now accepting applications for the Bush Fellowship through September 21st. Learn more about the Bush Fellowship online at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 21st. The Garrison Dam, which went into operation in 1955, is the fifth largest earthen dam in the world. Its construction created Lake Sacagawea. The lake is a popular recreation destination for fishing, boating, camping, and hiking, with three state parks and an Audubon National Wildlife Refuge located along its shoreline. Lake Sakakawea covers 307,000 acres. At 178 miles long, it is the second largest man-made lake in the United States. The deepest point is 180 feet, with an average depth of 42 feet. The surface area of the lake is over 350,000 acres. Garrison Dam holds back trillions of gallons of water. Concerns about the safety of the dam have surfaced over the years. A failure of the dam would be catastrophic. According to Jeff Greenwald, project manager for a dam safety study, North Dakota cities, including the capital of Bismarck, would see significant damage. Bridges and roads would be washed away, and 12 states would be impacted. On this date in 1962, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Berry of the Army Corps of Engineers addressed rumors of a leak at the dam. He reassured downstream residents that the dam was safe. He said the rumors of a leak were prompted by some minor work being done on the spillway. Concerns resurfaced in 2011 when a Missouri River flood exposed weaknesses in the spillway. Flows, more than twice the previous record, were reached as 150,000 cubic feet per second passed through the spillway. An inspection of the dam following the flood revealed a potential risk. The rushing water had peeled away one of the 28 manhole covers, allowing water to enter a drainage system designed to collect seepage and prevent frost damage. It was not designed to handle rushing floodwater. In a response to the 2011 flood, the Army Corps of Engineers initiated a study to identify potential problems in the dam and devise solutions. The study identified improvements that could be made in the spillway to avoid problems posed by severe storms. Jeff Greenwald, the lead planner on the project, said that when it comes to managing risk at an Army Corps of Engineers dam, public safety really is the number one priority, and we take that very seriously. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear that in the past decade or so, more and more Indigenous language and immersion schools have been funded and built across Indian country, with a mission to revitalize Indigenous languages around the world. Madeline will also stop by. He'll review A Haunting in Venice, the latest film based on a book by Agatha Christie. And we hope you'll join us again tomorrow on Main Street.